Welcome to the Ideal Spaces Working Group podcast.
Hello, welcome to our Ideal Spaces podcast with Thomas Kolbe. We are Grant Rainham and Ulrich Gehmann from the Ideal Spaces Foundation, and have a very interesting interview with Thomas Kolbe about the image of the human from a libertarian perspective, which is a perspective not very in use today, at least as regards discourses about images of the human. Mr. Kolbe, please.
Yes, hello. It's a great honor to be here. Thank you for the invitation. My name is Thomas Kolbe, born in Germany in the year 1978, in Neuss. It's near Cologne, Düsseldorf, in the Rhineland. After school, I've studied economics and was I received the typical education. You can imagine modern universities, mainly Keynesian distraction from real economics. So after these studies, I studied beside my work as a free agent for media, and I studied philosophy and history, all in Düsseldorf and Cologne, because my real interest always was to combine history with economics and understanding how these processes really work. And what I learned after 2-3 years in university was really there's something fishy about all of these theories of aggregate demand, and we need to control money supply. So I went down the rabbit hole to libertarianism some years later on. I had this addiction to the liberal side in Germany until I realized these guys clearly belong to the Keynesian camp too. So I was a little bit trapped because there was nobody I could talk to until I really discovered years ago the Austrian school. That's something that's never taught in German universities. I think in America and England, it's the same problem. They have the same narrative. State needs to control economic processes. If not, we are falling back into the medieval ages. That's what I discovered. And so I came down to the Austrian school, Ludwig von Mises, Menger, the classics. And that's where I am. And I think there's a big ethical and philosophical background of Austrian economics to discover, still to discover, especially in the public space. That's why I'm here.
Many thanks for this introduction. Let me start right away going into the heart of the matter. What are the core elements of a libertarian image of the human?
It all starts if you see the individual in the main focus of your philosophical ethical thinking with a non-aggression principle. So you can derive from that the right of the individual to develop its own ethical groundwork, its own private property, without being attacked by government players, by other individuals. This is something like a sphere that protects us. It's like the basics of freedom that makes up the libertarian thinking of the individual. And it comes along with a lot of ethical premises, like you need to treat the others. It's like a little bit Kant. You need to treat the others like you want to be treated. So if you say, private property for me, it's the same right for anybody. You don't have the right to intervene without negotiation, without a private contracting. And that's the fundament of from where we argue in any part, in any kind of social interaction.
It's a very good base as a starting point. Related to this, which are the philosophical traditions that influence libertarian thinking and concepts?
You can reach a little bit back. If you say, well, there's a libertarian movement in the 19th century, clearly to be identified, yeah, in America, even in Europe, where it led to a free market capitalism, to this epoch in the 19th century in America, where growth was so strong, where society opened up to these ideas without even analyzing it. There was no central bank, there was no central planning. The type of industrialization pushed the people from the countryside into the cities. And so there was a hell of work to do on the social economic sphere. And it was well done because markets were open, people were open-minded, and they let things work. You know, there's still, to understand the root of libertarianism, I don't know if I should go that far, but if you watch in antiquity, where the Europeans really developed for the first time, a sense of liberty, it was in the Persian wars of Athenians, of the Greeks. It was when Rome tried to push back the power of Etruscan kings, 509 before Christ. So we have a tradition where something like citizens formed their self-consciousness of responsibility for their own community. And maybe you can start developing liberal thinking in these days, but not like we understand it today. The libertarian has another point of view. A strong community is one thing, but you are responsible in the meantime for yourself, for your family, for your nearby surrounding. That's your sphere of responsibility. Anything else is a construction of interests. It's cooperation. It's hopefully voluntarily done, the city states in northern Italy. When you see when Renaissance really, really started to influence trade, art, when there was growth, it was when these city states, little units of power, decided to develop something like negotiation and solutions on this basis with other city states. It was not a big state, like national state, like we know today, that focused on power, centralized its power to decide for their people. So the libertarian movement has a lot of roots in the non-aggression principle, like I said, in the antiquity when they started to develop the city-state principles, when even the Romans started to develop public law, private law, they divided powers. Anything that led to civilization like we know today has some kind of root for our libertarian thinking today. It's the last step in the evolution of society.
It's a very interesting perspective also as regards the evolution, the interpretation of evolution. Which leads to my next points. When you spoke about the first city-states, or also Italian medieval and Renaissance city-states, which in my eyes can be regarded next to the idea of the Greek polis as one of the bases of Occidental development, also in cultural terms, the Italian independent city-states. What about the relation between the individual with its right and the community in the sense of an, let's say, organized democratic polis, which has to follow some rules that are above the individual, that transcend the individual. The individual can keep free, of course, but in a certain framework. What about this framework in relation to community, to the individual? It's a question about the state in the end.
Yeah, you can see this very abstract. You can a little bit put it away from our situation to an abstract observation. In general, any individual finds itself in a social black box or in a social network that he has to deal with. So if you maybe you're buying property in a community, you're moving there with your family and you start interacting there with the marketplace, buying your food, offering your work or whatever. In this moment, you start integrating yourself into the existing set of rules. you accept the basic ethics, the morals of the place, of this place where you find yourself. And that's something that's in us. We like to be part of a community that's growing. So we will accept and we will choose communities that looks proper, that looks growing, that seems to have a perspective. And so there's a natural form of human capital. I would call it like this without insulting anyone. It's not unethical to say it, but human capital as individuals too will be moving to the places where it's offered the best possibilities to open itself, to open up itself, to grow your family, to grow your wealth. That's something natural. And that's something that, as we will be maybe talking later about, what centralized power units. Think about the Diocletian state of Rome. It was the first time that the centralized power put the people into that place. They were called colonies, people that couldn't move away from where they once were born. That was the foundation of the feudal system we later on saw fully developed in the medieval age. And it's something, mobility, personal mobility, physically, mentally, that's the groundwork of every civilization. So again, as an individual, you start integrating yourself automatically by interacting, negotiating, you accept the rules, and that's how the process always works if there's no intervention by force.
This is a very essential point of this libertarian image of the human in the positive sense. The question is there something as regards community? As an individual, I can be free. I'm still living in a community. As regards the community, is there something like a common good, which as a benefits which directly or indirectly apply to the community as a whole?
Yeah, if I understand your question correctly, it's like a common good to have, for example, a prospering community. That's something that spreads out, like the word is spreading out, and that attracts more capital, that attracts more individuals that will contribute to further growth, further stability, further social security that is also provided by the private entities in the system. So in the end, growth is always an indicator for a mindset, a set of rules, morals that seems to be working in this moment of time, this place. And that's something like, therefore we need transparency and competition, small units. I know the conservative friends of the national state won't like to hear it. Actually, I'm here in Spain. We have some problems, you might know, in the north, but a fundamental right should be secession. So if a community likes to leave because it is plundered by a central entity, by a central power, it should have the right, because only if the right of secession exists, there's real competition. If not, anybody is put under the same umbrella, and if it rains and the central force puts away the protection, they all fail. So the right of secession is fundamentally to fulfill the main point. Competition between communities is healthy. It keeps them in check, it keeps the power in check, and the individual can grow within it. So it's very important. Secession should be mentioned in any book about economics or in social economics or political economics.
This is an interesting perspective too. If we prolong this perspective as a question, this means in the end decentralization, at least as an aim.
Yeah. Look. After the Second World War, since the Second World War, the number of sovereigns grew by 90, nearly doubled. So we see this tendency, and after seven decades or eight decades, to me it's proof that this might be part of the social evolution we are making through. Yeah, we are. It's easy to distract us by the news every day. Yeah, you see the big war in Ukraine, you see the conflict in the Middle East. That overshadows all that's growing, it's going on under the hood. And what I would say is there's a tendency, even in Europe, the European Union won't be the final solution for the continent. It's another topic, I know, but I see it exactly contradicting what the social evolution will be, in my opinion. Maybe I'm totally wrong in this, but I don't see it. I don't see unification processes, no.
Okay, yeah, the outlining of perspective is relevant for presenting the entire context that the things are embedded in. Yeah. Let me go back on the common good. And what about when we are speaking about the common good, when we are speaking about community, in the end, we touch the topic of social justice. And this is a main point of criticism today as regards the recent form of the so-called neoliberal capitalism with all its shortfalls in economic and social terms. What about us when we look again at this image of the human from a libertarian perspective? What's about social justice?
Yeah, it always comes back to this. Let's start with the growth of the welfare state. I think when Bismarck started this initiative, it was like some concession to the Social Democrats just to stabilize his political realm. And it has nothing to do with growth or welfare state. And it's a vehicle. The welfare state, in the end, like we see it today, it's growing without checks and balances. It's growing its own bureaucracy. It's growing the dependency of a growing part of the people. Social justice can be measured in economics. They do it sometimes very easily with this Gini coefficient. I don't know if you know it. I just read it yesterday that the most centralized countries in the 20th century, Soviet Union, China, in the end, they had the highest in injustice, economical injustice and distribution of all the countries. The 25 countries with open markets, you find them now in Asia, like Vietnam, Korea, and they had a more just distribution, because the open market is the measurement for your contribution to society in the economic sense. So if you say the 1% in the United States are paying more or less 35% and somewhat of the taxes, income taxes every year, the 1% of the most richest people, 35%. So to me, it sounds like a lot of money. If you follow the German discussion on social justice, it's always like, no, the free market doesn't work. We've never seen a free market capitalist system, at least in Europe. We saw it partially in America in the 19th century, and boom, the growth went through the roof. What we need in Europe is an open and fair debate. We have state quota of 50 to 60% in the Eurozone member states, 50 to 60%. So in the end, half of every euro goes to the hands of the state. And it's bureaucrats and it's technocrats. It's going anywhere. If you see the healthcare system, costs are exploding, like the education system. They're not more doctors per thousand people. There are more bureaucrats working, because these entities are growing out of themselves. They are aiming for more power, for more budget. There's no checks by a free market. So this system, the system needs to grow like this. It needs to occupy more money and more resources, and the private sector is shrinking. It needs to contribute more of its productive power to maintain all the parts of the parasitic parts of society, to maintain it in balance. So what I would suggest is we should choose examples where more market, free market capitalism was realized, to compare to the system we have today. And then we can say, well, the results there are better. Here we are shrinking. We have entered a phase where there's no economic growth anymore. The social system is growing. It's the last part of the, I always say, if you're searching for growth in Europe, watch to the welfare state. And that's not growth. That's consumption. That's destruction. And that's a path that goes directly to the economic abyss. So what I would say historically, politicians build up their own second army besides the party system in their welfare state, and all these bubbles that are growing around to protect it. If it's the media bubble that's creating narratives how important the welfare state is, it stabilizes the economy. No. It's destabilizing society, because the incentive to contribute with creativity, with your efforts, with your money, with your capital, to growth, to prosperity, they're shrinking, they're destroyed by the system. So we need exactly the opposite. Shrinking the welfare state, coming back to private property, private capital formation. That's something I would suggest. But this type of development won't end until it's collapsed. And it collapsed. And look at Argentina, look at other states. We have problems in England and Great Britain now. These problems are surrounding us. And the reality, you can ignore it until reality comes back to you.
It's an interesting point, because the critique, why then the critique on this neoliberal capitalism as it exists today in terms of growing systemic instability, mm-hmm. in terms of growing social injustice, and so on?
Yeah, it's quite easy. If you have a consensus, a political and media consensus of, we need a strong state, we need a strong government that needs to control public narratives, that needs to control half of the GDP, that needs to, then you're playing in the cards of the governing class. And these people have their own problems. I don't want to go in this rabbit hole now, but if you see the selection, like I say, who's going to be selected next? The White House, who's going to be selected in Brussels? These people have their own problems to maintain their narratives, to grow their power. So therefore, I would say the libertarians, even the liberals, if there wouldn't be any, they are the needle that's always looking for the balloon and to pop all the false narratives. I can give you a very interesting example. 1920 to 1921, the United States entered into a sharp depression, worse than 29. The president came into office, it was Harding. Harding, media and economics are always talking very bad about this man. No? He was an idiot and whatever. Do you know what he did? The GDP dropped by 20, 25, 30% nearly. He did nothing. He didn't even advise the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates, like it's a reflex from the neo Keynesians now. No, you have a little bit problems in the economy, lower interest rates. It's always the same mechanism. They did nothing. And the economy grew after 6 months. Again, it shot up. And if you talk to Keynesians about this phenomena, they say, it may be the exception of the rule. We don't really get it, why it happened that fast. 9 years later, 8 years later, 29, 30, 31, the reaction was exactly the playbook we know today. Great deal that followed to establish for the first time a real welfare state in America. And look what happened. The great theft began. They installed an active central bank that is playing with the money supply to push money into the markets, the main part of this money always goes into the assets of those who are very near to the money printer. It's a Cantillon effect. It's a very well documented effect. You can see if you have the assets before they decide, you can fill your bags. And what the poor part of the population always receives in this system is inflation. Did you ever realize that central banks tell you openly, yeah, we need 2% inflation every year to show that we have a growing economy? They say openly, we only need to rob 2% of your purchasing power every year to be satisfied, but it's more, claro. They manipulate the inflation data. The CPI, CPI is something for the comic books. No, in a market economy, you have deflation. Competition always brings down prices. Entrepreneurs in a free market capitalist system are hunting margins. And where there's a high margin, capital moves first and then bring it down. And who's benefiting from this? The consumer. And what they are doing now effectively is hurting the consumer, pushing up asset prices for their friends and Wall Street, wherever they're sitting. And that's the new two-tier society we are witnessing.
Okay, then two questions from the outside of economics, so to say.
Yeah, very economic. Yeah.
No, this is good. But two questions from the outside, facts. No, how then this market model can explain the existence and the growing number of poor people, also in really desolate and fragile situations, and related, how this model can explain the fact of monopolies when there is no free market in real terms any longer, but only some international, very, very large monopolists dictating the game. This is no free market.
Okay, first, what I would say about poverty is, if you see how real poverty, so the less of provision with goods of necessity, like housing, like nutrition, it dropped from 80% 100 years ago to 16, 17, 10 years ago. So I would say, the little market economy we let be working over the decades made this possible. The high process of innovation, of distribution, these ideas, look at the fridge, the cars, mobility, information system, healthcare, all these innovations were spreading very fast thanks to open markets. And poverty, whatever you can tell about capitalism, again, we didn't see it. We see parts of capitalism. If you like to see the full force of it, you need to talk to Ursula von der Leyen. And maybe we can push the barrier with this woman a little bit, but I don't know. Poverty is plummeting thanks to the innovation cycle of capitalism, where it's allowed to be. And thanks. I think we talked once about it, something human in the Greek philosophy called the timos, the wish to be part of a growing economy, the wish to spread the good word, to spread the good. That's something that defines us as human beings. That's something Marxists will never admit. But the people that made the big money in the past, take the German Hanse, this late medieval phase of trade. These people designed their cities privately. There was no command, no city command. They designed it by public goods made by private capital, so private goods for the public, like residencies, like widow houses. Yeah, they provided all the wealth they needed to have a stable, growing, prospering community with a safety net. It was done by private hands. And this force, this thumos, is something I think it's radically underdeveloped in theory and economics, even in modern philosophy. There's small, little talk about it, but it's a main driving force. And I don't know how to make the bridge to your second question now, but I will leave it here. In my opinion, poverty dropped radically. We could have been very, very fast in this process if we would permit it a little bit more of market economy. But we see the tendency since the 70s, since they dropped the gold standard, there's more manipulation of markets, there's more money printing, there's more government spending. So we are going the wrong direction. So if there's a setback one day, we shouldn't be surprised. But I leave it like this. The second question about the monopoly. What we see in a real free market system, there wouldn't be public goods, there wouldn't be monopolies. Again, if there's a margin and you have open markets without regulation, that's the condition. There can't be politicians regulating a monopoly. In this moment, there's no market entry possible. Any free capital, any entrepreneur will hunt margins. So if there, maybe, for example, you had Boeing, the dominating plane manufacturer. And then the Europeans thought maybe it's necessary to put a second company of the same size, same scale into the market. They took, I don't have the numbers now in mind, but they took a lot of taxpayers' money to establish a second economy. There were several mid-sized companies here in Europe active in the market. They pushed them out partially and established their state monopoly, or partially state public company. And you wouldn't tell me that there wouldn't have been, at one point in the market process, initiative by some companies, by some investors, to hunt this margin. Never.
This is one thing. The other thing is the evolutionary tendency of a formally free market by itself. If we have monopolies, not stately assisted ones, Google, for instance, not assisted by the state, but it has a very dominant position, to avoid the word monopoly. In any case, the real free market is disturbed. And the real free market is a, if I understood it properly, is a premise for the positive utopia of a real unfolded capitalism, about which you said that the real unfolded, the real powerful force of capitalism has not been unfolded yet. Since the days of the United States 19th century, we have not experienced what could be the benefit of such a capitalism. But if this presupposes assumption, the existence of a really free market, and if we have no really free market, what now?
If we have a free market, what will grow at first is the division of labor. We're seeing exactly the opposite now. Look, the bifurcation of the world, of the economic world, into the BRICS bloc and the, can we say it's still G7, the influence of, let's say, European-American economies. That's a very, very difficult, problematic development, in my opinion. Of course, I see in the future, because there are necessities on both sides. Look at Russia. Russia doesn't want the dependence on China. In the long run, the Russians will need the Europeans as a market too, like the Europeans need the energy markets of Russia. This thing will be gone in some years, even if it doesn't look like. The sheer necessity will bring the blocs at one point again with new bridges of diplomacy, new bridges on the markets, maybe a new gold standard like they tried to establish. There will be bridges to provide solutions for more international labor, division of labor. So if we open up markets here in Europe, for example, you will see it, like capital and people would move to efficient parts of the, to grow the economy again. But we need to understand that it's so important. Look, what they're doing in Brussels with the Green New Deal, it's a classical Keynesian intervention. You realize as a politician, we have overregulated the economy. There's no real growth anymore. There's no in investments. There's no capital, private capital formation of relevance. What can we do now? We establish a nice narrative. The burning planet.
Yeah, but we
and
have.
Then we go, and then we grow a credit system. Then we grow.
Virtually problems. We do or not. Narrative.
Yeah, we establish this. Then we establish this credit mechanism.
Okay.
And then we grow an economy, and you can see it in the data in the German economy where it's done excessively. It's not working. They're pushing out. It's called the crowding out. We have this interest rate mechanism. They're pushing out the private formation of capital, and what they bring in is recession, stagnation, inflation. So now, what do we do? What can we do now? In my opinion, we are in. It's really five minutes before 12. We are nearing a political crisis in Europe and in Germany that we can't control. Maybe one day, and so it would be in our interest to come back to more free economy, to bring capital distribution allocation back on track, and to grow what we need for society.
Okay, let's take this scenario in the positive sense, this perspective, in the direction of a capitalist utopia to come, which is not meant negative. It's about Dumas and utopia, about this relation. Seen from this background, what is the concept in the libertarian image of the human as regards the theme of social justice? There have been many, many, many discussions from both sides, also the left side and the, let's say, pro-capital side. I mean it neutral. About the phenomenon of social justice, how to achieve it in today's or modernist non-decentralized entities. We are not living any longer in a Greek polis or in a Renaissance city-state. We are living in the age of large agglomerations with large statal administrations. So there is a huge overhead of management because we are many people. Seen in this context and with the non-existence of truly free markets on a global scale, what about social justice?
Yeah, in our libertarian utopia, and now I have something nice to say for the conservatives. The free market system will bring back responsibility to yourself, for your family, because there's nobody you can refer to. If you don't make it in the market, you have to try it again. You have to try your income. Yeah, and there's still your social network. You are responsible to construct it. You can't say, I'm leaving home with 18 years and the state, so someone is going to pay for my life. And let's see, maybe I'm going to study, maybe I'm going to work a little bit as a waiter some hours every week. No, you have to channel your energy to have a fundament for your own life. So this will bring back something the left, maybe the political radical left, doesn't like to hear. It will bring back some family values. There's nothing more important if you see social stability to the eyes of the individual and your own family.
And for people without having a family, there is a growing tendency in Western countries, at least since years, for...
Why? Why is it? But who's responsible for this? It's in my opinion, if you draw the responsibility of the individual and the family onto the shoulders of an abstract like the welfare state, what you're bringing in is a bunch of people that think there's no ethics for me, there's no limits. I will party until my last day.
What about the other people having no jobs, living in precarious conditions, living alone, who are not this kind of parasites, who want to work but who are poor, who want to have a family but living alone?
Just to say before, in the radical free market system, there would be less. Another level of poverty, because the people would put more efforts into their living, into their work. From the very beginning, you know, if you're 15, 16, 17 years old, one day I will do it. I have to do it. I have to do my own, finance my own life. So 80, 90% of those you can see now living in the welfare state, that have these people have a very nice living. And you're educating their children and their children to live the same lifestyle like they call
it.
You can cut 80-90% of these people out. What you do with the rest? Still, like I said, first part, your own effort. Second, your own family. Third, friends, social surrounding, offer your work. There are communities that will hold up. And then there comes sets this in what I call this Thymos, capital of Thymos. People with money in their own district with responsibility, not after having paid 60% of taxes. I'm talking about an income tax of 0, maybe 5%. These people will finance houses for the poor, but for 100%. There won't be like, look what happens in America, where you now have this welfare system. Look what we have in Europe with a very, very big, grown, scaled up welfare state. How many people are living in the streets? The poverty level is the consequence of this system. They made it worse. They made it worse. You didn't have these problems. During the industrialization, the free market managed to integrate 90% of the population moving into the city centers. Crazy numbers.
But nowadays we have the aftermath of the success of large non-state-owned companies, like, for instance, Google, Facebook, and so on and so on. We have this phenomenon of the so-called fourth world, where people formerly installed as employees in these companies are living on the streets in tents in cities like San Francisco. It is not Bangladesh. This
country. What I told you. If you follow the Austrian economics business cycle, what's happening here is you enter into a recession. Our politicians won't let this mechanism of short, sharp recession washing out the bad capital, the bad companies, work out. They will say, lower the interest rate, push cheap credit, cheap money into the system, manipulate the time preference of the people that they start spending, inflation goes up, wages lower, we have a labor market, a positive labor market effect by this mechanism that works some rounds, of, like we see now, that works for decades, but it leaves millions of people in the dust. Mm-hmm. Those are the people nobody's talking about. The victims of the welfare state system, the interventionism, the statism we see that now brings up the state to 60% here in Europe. And what I say is we need to crush this business cycle, establish a set of rules, free market rules, away with the central banking. This needs to stop. Politicians never shouldn't have the power about the money supply. That's the biggest devolutionary element we have in our time, that you give a political case the power of manipulating the price of money that has an impact on anybody's life. They can manipulate half of any transaction. That brings us economically down, and the distribution of wealth doesn't work like this.
If you... distribution of wealth can happen in a free, really, really free capitalist market. The background is there has been often the argument of the so-called trickle-down effect. When rich people, some of the wealth accumulated by rich people will trickle down to the rest of the population. What about this? Because it's essential for the whole.
Yeah, let me tell it like this. To me, it's important that we have private formation of capital. We need to allocate capital in a decentralized way. And that's only possible by private hands. And if you have a very rich conglomerate of people, maybe a company, you know, like Berkshire Hathaway in America, the biggest one of the biggest investors, of course, that they have a pricing power in the sense of they can, in a way, in the short term, have an impact on the stock exchange, share prices, maybe on interest rates, on the refinancing process of companies. That's true. But again, the free market will wash them out if they make mistakes. They can't. Warren Buffett wouldn't hold up a monopoly, even with 10 times of his money. He wouldn't hold up a monopoly. There would be market forces, again, hunting this delta, this margin that brings prices of his companies or the products of his companies down on the level that the consumer needs. That's why, you know, the distribution doesn't work like, well, I start off with 20 years, I go to work a little bit, and why do I need more money? Yeah, then I need to learn more, then I need to study more, then I need to work more. You need to bring in efforts. That's maybe something that has been forgotten during the last decades of two very successful generations of Germans that worked harder than my generation. Obviously, you can't neglect that fact. And they, after the Second World War, worked far harder. And they accumulated their money because they still lived with Ludwig Erhard, for example. There was economics minister, later chancellor, that really understood. He was from the Austrian economic school. He really understood the importance of free markets.
And he established the social market economy, as you call
it. Yeah, he called it social market because he didn't want to tell the Germans that social market economy is BS too. He didn't want to confront his poor Germans with the fact that the little plant they are growing, it's called socialism. Every generation is growing it a little bit higher. That somebody should tear it out of the soil and let the little plants grow besides. He wouldn't tell it to the people, but he made it. He exactly tried to free the markets where it was necessary.
Okay. What would be your kind of facit as regards the consequences of a libertarian image of the human regarding the shaping of society?
Well,
how it could look like as a in perspective, what needs to be done in
order
a real poor society.
There's something we don't really appreciate enough. We have access to all the knowledge, mm-hmm. to all the books, the podcasts, videos, interviews, of Austrian economics you could ever have. It's all for free. You can consume this knowledge for free in some weeks if you are quite open-minded. And then you can compare this, we call it utopia, to the, I don't want to say dystopia, utopia of the other side. We can easily compare it. And then we can, and then we can try to put the view these people have of the human being with its characteristics, with its incentive structure, with its behavior, to this characterization we have as libertarians. We say we have this very optimistic view on future, on the individual. We have this optimistic view that even the greatest anybody can think about ethics on his own level. I mean it in a positive way. Anybody can feel that behaving to other people stealing, engaging with bad people, that doesn't grow your character. Anybody can feel this.
It is true, and greed does also not grow your character.
Greed, you know, it's they often use this word to attack us. Yeah, look, these capitalists.
It was a point.
But these capitalists. If I, without being cynical, somebody is going to work, and there comes his union and says, "What do you think? We can hire your wage by 15% this year, but 5% of your colleagues have to go." I bet 90% of the people will say, "I don't give a SH, hire with my wage." Is this greed? Is this self-interest? I would say from if you read von Mises' Praxeology, the theory of human behavior, without psychological impact, our axiom is anybody, any individual tries to be better tomorrow, better off tomorrow than today. That's something natural. You don't want that your children living worse than you live. You don't want to live worse in 10 years than you live today. So you will channel energy, you will grow social networks to benefit from them. And by contributing to these contacts, maybe you do some work in a local residence with some elder people. You grow again by your thymos, by your own feeling. You're giving something to the community. This will grow rapidly. If the state withdraws, people come in, and they come in by force. We can see it. In Germany, 22 million people still working voluntarily in sports, elderly care.
They think what they do is meaningful, and therefore they are working. They do a meaningful job in their person.
Yeah.
This is indirectly, at least, community related.
Exactly.
To the point in the beginning.
Exactly. Without the engagement of the people, personal interest, Timos, the scaled up Timos, there wouldn't be a society worth living in. So.
This is the standard critique on the existing capitalist realized model. In fact, the critique says it's a society not worth living in.
Yeah, and it's exactly again. That's this Orwellian talk of the left, of the radical left. They're putting it always on top.
Okay.
First, we didn't see a capitalist world in Europe. Never. Never, we have no idea what it is. We can imagine what it would be. But what we see is growing state interventionism, growing state funds, growing welfare state to a level that's unsustainable. Anybody knows this? In the next 4 to 5 years, 3.5 million Germans, or 2.8, some million Germans will be into jubilee, you know? How do we finance this? Nobody's talking about it. Hiring, pushing up the entry age, maybe lowering state rent. Something has to be done, and nobody's talking about it. The free market solution would have been, let the people the money. Don't steal them. Don't rob them blind so that they can build up their own safety net. Let the money in the families. They will know better than the state bureaucrats how to grow it. Or believe me, they know it if they have the responsibility and they know there's no bailout. Like for banksters, there will be no bailout if you play around with your money. You will see how they channel energy. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. But that, maybe just to conclude this one, that's the other perspective. We as libertarians, we are convinced that the human being deserves the name Homo sapiens, sapiens, in a way that he's able to adapt to new situations, that he's able to be creative, to cooperate, and always with this move forward. If you look, the whole process of globalization, what is it? It's another form of adjustment, of tumbling forward into a fork that we need to regulate in a sense of channeling energy, not a state that says you can produce this one, you can deliver there. Mm-hmm. No, we need to activate, to provoke all the creativity and all the decentralized forces of 8 billion people to grow as a big community. And this factor greed, like you call it, that's your self-interest. That's necessary to get up in the morning and to start being part of this anonymous motor that's working all the time in this world. Without this self-interest, this incentive to say, tomorrow I'm better off than today. Why should you get up in the morning? Why shouldn't you wait for someone of the welfare state to pay for you? Dim your light, stay in bed.
This is the very essence, not meant badly. This is this image of the human, which is of importance. This is the basic assumptions making up the human being as regards these beings, let's say, primary anthropological interests.
Leads you to
another discussion. And here we have perhaps a difference or not. In regards to left conceptions, because what you said about the community and the development of individuals inside a community, plus minus the same could be said as a prospect from socialist people, as a what you called leftist, as a, they could say, well, this too is our perspective and directive to go to.
Maybe I should add, when I say the radical left, I mean the radical right and radical left together. It's for me the same program. The idea behind this private property, mm-hmm. that's easily said, but that's fundamental to understand cultural processes. If you guarantee, not only via constitution, by force, private property and the private right society, then you have the opposite of the radical left and radical right. It's a third way. In the main center, the main stage of society will be your right to earn, to maintain, and to grow your own stack. And if you start thinking from this perspective, the state as an abstract, and in all its forms, we see defense, educational system, whatever there is intervening, yeah, the state gets to, or shrinks to a player in this box of forces, to a very hostile player. That's something a lot of right-wing and left-wing people don't understand. The state in this understanding tries to absorb more of the energy that's flourishing, that's turning around, and therefore we are in the position of really fighting against both blocks. That makes it interesting, but a little bit difficult sometimes, as you might imagine, because any of these people will say, ah, he belongs to them, he belongs to them. So there's, it's politically, it's difficult. It's, if you see it from the media point of view, to communicate it, it's in the end quite easy, because if you understand the axioms of our philosophy, if you start with the individual, with the axiom of non-aggression, with the axiom of private property, the private contracting, the private contract state, then anything becomes clear. The fog you have about how do we grow the state, how do we shrink it, it disappears. And we are growing solutions for negotiating between individuals. We are by permitting and guaranteeing privacy rights, the whole debate about pollution and in nature disappears. Why? Because anybody has to pay for the damage he's done. Look how it was in the past. There was a chemistry industry pushing all their waste into the river. So fish died, there was no other industry possible. Nobody paid for it. They used it like a gratis dumping ground. By guaranteeing the right of the fishermen of using this part, this company would have compensated with a very high price. And they would have thought of maybe we find another solution. Look, and all the progress we see in the environment policy has been done by market solution. All the innovation we see come from private companies. The state doesn't innovate nothing. That's something to stress again and again. The state doesn't solve. He brings in the problems.
Yeah, this is one of your basic assumptions as regards the image of the human, this conditio humana. It lacks the state lacks thumos, and without thumos, there is no real initiative.
Yeah, it's like the hat. It's like the hat of Janus.
Yeah.
One side looks forward, the other part of the hat backwards. But in the sense of time, I would interpret this type of Janus hat like, I'm watching to grow myself, but I'm very interested in the growth of the members of my community. I have a very high interest that my neighbor is better off too.
Clear.
You understand, yeah? Beside the fact that sometimes your neighbor can really piss you off, but in general, if you're seeing here your city, the part of the city where I'm living, and there's some people better off, it's good for me. There's less criminality. Kids are in good shape, playing a good atmosphere. The neighbors are in good shape. They're growing. And I don't want to be part of a diminishing, shrinking, crumbling, or tumbling community. So it's in my self-interest. And if I could contribute, well, look, we have here in Spain, we have a lot of homeless people. The first thing you do is giving something. I'm still not in the process of organizing something. I'm not Warren Buffett, obviously, but giving something, asking for, you like a coffee? Huh? I go to the supermarket. What you need? Something you should do if you can. Mm-hmm. And if you put these both pieces together, your own incentives, your own self-interest, and the needs for your community, and the thumos, this having to push them up to. I don't see why anybody should have an interest to rob us blind before even being capable of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Look, it's not in the interest of the state. If you see the logic of the welfare system, they can't have the interest of, hopefully there won't be any homeless people, hopefully there won't be any jobless people next year. Then they are jobless. In the logic of a growing bureaucracy, the problem they pretend to solve needs to grow. And then the state can say, look, there's this problem. Look, we have the solution.
It's also a question of sheer numbers of people. It comes back to this decentralization point, together with what you outlined about a positive and very direct communal life. When you give the man a coffee, and this is a start, perhaps this man can get a job. Perhaps you know somebody where he can work as, I don't know what, as a start at least. And this is community, and this is also community, and this implies small numbers of people. You have to know this guy when you're crossing the street. As you said it with this Hanse or with this Italian city-state examples, there have been historical investigations about the city of Siena, for instance, in the medieval ages. When I, as a rich merchant living next door to poorer people, we have to be friendly to each other because we meet us every day. And there is exchange. But what happens if we have, in the German case, 82 millions of people with social erosion, with no identity, as with all the social and mental problems that occur out of whichever reasons now in the course of modernity, where this feeling for community and this decentralized viable entity is missing. There is no viable decentralized entity. We have just big cities, we have urban agglomerations, of course with their local communities and of course with alternatives to re-establish a real communal life. But overall, too many people, and this explains the reason for the state. We need a large management organization called state in order to handle these problems. Like Norbert Elias said it already in the 30s of the 20th century, the relation between mass and power. Also the masses exercise some power in the end. And how to handle these masses of people with a large management organization called the state. And then,
How do you deal with it? Yeah, this is the illusion. This is the illusion. You mentioned the Hanse. In the 20, 30 years ago, twice a year, I traveled to Lübeck. Lübeck, for those who don't know it, it's maybe not from Germany, nearby, near the East Sea, the Baltic Sea, in the northeast of Hamburg.
Yeah, one Hanse city.
Yeah, that's where the Manns were born. And one of my favorite novels was the Buddenbrooks from Thomas Mann. I think he gained the Nobel Prize for this with 23 years over. So he described the life of a commercial family, the Buddenbrooks. It's like a mirror of his own family of the past. And this book really, really set me in flames for the city. So I went there, I was studying every street. So I studied any building they built. Like the residency that was still in work 15 years ago, or also 400 years old, the building. And then I realized you can feel it in every word. He was describing the pride of his family living in a healthy society, in a growing society. The word growth. We need to negotiate. We need to invest. Our pride is here's no poverty. And so I understood it like this. These people lived by their contacts they had to northern Italy, to Amsterdam, to France, to the north, to Scandinavia, to Russia, Novgorod. And when they received their trading partners in their hometown, and there would have been poverty in the streets, homeless people. How could you even look in the eyes of your partners that you had a lot of communication maybe before, describing your rich city and your success, and saying, oh well, I obviously didn't see them. No, it was their pride that nobody there in the streets was homeless, people at work, the people that lost maybe their husbands in the sea. They were financed their lives. It was a great time to grow the spirit of a city-state. Like, it was nearly organized like Northern Italy some 100 years before, until they founded the German Union, the Norddeutschen Bund, where there were big problems to integrate all these city-states, because they pretended to be autonomous. Mm-hmm. And maybe, I think so, we'll find back on this track. And like you say, this big apparatus you need to manage what it's really unmanageable will fall apart, and we'll have state units much, much smaller than we see now. It's like, look, where's the real success in the last 50 years? Hong Kong, Singapore, Switzerland, something else? I don't know, maybe. But it's always, if you see small units of power that's integrative, people feel home, feel responsible, maybe it's another feeling. I never lived in Singapore, would like to, but if I go here to the countryside of Spain, you are very fast integrated into the communities. You feel, it's a different feeling. And maybe we are partly shifting back or forward to this again.
With a very interesting prospect towards decentralization.
Dividing power, libertarian principle. Divide power as far as you can.
Maybe of the Greek polis or the Italian city-state, it's the decentralization ideal in the end. After the downfall of the big management unities called states, we will return to more human life in a decentralized way.
Yeah, you can see it in the Greek tragedy when Aeschylus or Sophocles, when they were celebrating the city-state after the triumph on the Persian Empire Persian Empire, there was the proof that a small group of city-states can unite temporarily and be successive against the biggest power of its time.
Yeah,
oh, what a pride. Yeah. What a pride for citizenship of Athens, Theban, whatever. All that participated in these liberation wars, and the heroic Sparta, all had its time. And for these people, like they tried to energize on it, like an artist, like Aeschylus, on the Persians, when he wrote this piece, he let the Greeks cry on the loss of Persia without cynicism. He let them cry when they heard about the destruction of Darius.
Yeah,
he let them cry because he knew, in the sense of, they didn't know it better, and they went blindly, blind by their power, by their centralized superpower, into the God-given trap.
This is a very interesting piece, Aeschylus, the Persians. Very, in different respects, a very interesting thing. Okay, many thanks for this introduction as regards the libertarian image of the human. Are there any questions from...
No, I thought it was a very, very interesting conversation. I mean, I think the flow was very nice between Thomas and Uli. So I just sort of got enjoyment listening to the conversation because it was very in-depth. And as always, we thank Thomas because he has a way of talking and communicating in dialogue that's really excellent, and we appreciate that.
Thank you.
Many thanks.